Okay, thank you, Jesse, for this vibrant talk. So now you can disagree or agree.
Yeah, so
or reinforce, yeah, okay.
Okay, so yeah, I guess the confidence with which I can say this depends a little bit on what you believe about the dark matter profile in the galaxy. But reasonable NWRI NASA profiles, thermal Meno dark matter is ruled out by Hess.
So already existing data?
Already existing published Hess results rule it out. Now, if there's like a kiloparsec size core in our galaxy, that would not be true. Now, so it sort of depends on what you think about that. At least the... Right, there's a Hess gamma ray line search, which sets a bound that rules it out by, I think, about a factor of two for sort of most reasonable NFWRI NASTO choices. No, it's a line search. It has to be a line search at high mass. The point is that the continuum rate is too small, but the line rate is approximately constant at high mass. And so, let me see where our plot is. Yeah, it's a factor of two or three. At the thermal relic value of about 2.5 TeV. That's distinctly apparent.
Now, I was just going to say, I think it's a little strong to say it's ruled out. I mean, there's a Hess line search. They have a constraint on the annihilation cross-section. It's a function of the mass. And if you look around 2 TeV, the constraint on the annihilation cross-section is about 10 to the minus 27 centimeter cubed per second,
right,
which is about what you would expect for Weno dark matter.
No, you expect a much larger. It's about... The annihilation cross-section for Renos is closer to 10 to the minus 26.
Yeah, so if you just take two sigma constraints and really believe that we know what the dark matter profile looks like in the galactic center, it's just that, in my experience, factors of two easily go away just by changing
astrophysics.
Yeah, factor
of two
is
sort of at the pessimistic value of the NFWRI NASTO profile.
So I'm not sure whether NFWRI NASTO is pessimistic or not.
Well, so that's a reason.
Yeah. Just because you're talking about gastrophysics.
If you have a kiloparsec size core, you get away from this completely.
Just because in the inner couple of hundred parsecs of the galaxy, we know that that's baryon dominated, and so
right.
Taking
so
an NFW profile
know that, but at least,
is pretty risky.
At least
so
the modelers I talk to seem to think that it's implausible that cold dark matter gives you a core that large.
There's a constraint. There's a number.
Right.
Whether or not you think, how strongly you think that's ruled out is sort of a matter of how strongly, you know, judgment issues come into place. I think the statement is that there are constraints there, they're relevant, they're getting stronger. And so, you know, even for these cases of the pure, so I'll actually show this plot this afternoon in my talk, and we can just look at it, compare it against the prediction, and then you can put whatever judgments you want on top of that.
Okay, I mean, I also have a plot, right? But so for Higgs-Zenos, to make another point, for pure Higgs-Zenos, the line rate is down at more like 10 to the minus 29, so that's still significantly out of reach. The continuum for Higgs-Zenos at the thermal value is about 10 to the minus 26, a little bit smaller than that. So both of those are out of reach. They're also out of reach of things like CTA. So you actually, at least for lines, they're out of reach of CTA. So you need to do quite a bit better if you're ever going to get to thermal Higgs-Zenos. It's not easy.
You probably already answered my question, that to what degree are you relying on the dark halo distribution in the galactic structure? I looked into simulations recently, and they are quite controversial. So I don't know to what degree you need the model for the dark halo.
I mean, the rate just goes like the number density squared. So insofar as you believe that you know the number density squared to within some factor, which, you know, there's a lot of dynamics within the inner couple hundred parsecs that can change that significantly, then rate will change. So, I mean, what people usually do is to take some profile and vary the profiles with different slopes and to look at the constraints And usually you can get a variation which is a factor of several in the overall rate. I typically don't feel very comfortable saying that something is ruled out till it's ruled out by an order of magnitude. But that is a matter of taste.
Okay.
All right.
Yes.
Can I change the subject? So can we go back to the previous slide? Yeah. So you made this comment about the ultimate LHC reach of mono plus anything, and you made it in the context of dark matter. But I think it's actually a much more generally important thing. So there's a very important, you know, scenarios in SUSY that are very hard probes, such as light Higgs-Zeno, and nothing else, or a very compressed spectrum. For all of the ultimate test is mono plus anything. So I think having a clear statement, hopefully from the collaborations themselves, of how far they can go in terms of cross-section in the searches for, you know, 300 and 3,000 in those femtobarns would be extremely useful for our planning here.
Do you have any sense of what the order of magnitude of that is?
So I wanted to follow up on what Katie had to say. I think it's conceptually wrong to say that something is ruled out when we really don't have a solid handle on the normalization of the astrophysical factor. One can be more or less optimistic. I think there are opportunities to see a signal with CTA for thermal Higgs-Zenos. If, for example, the density profile in dwarf spheroidal galaxies is steeper than we think, or in the galactic center. But I certainly would not subscribe to the statement that something is ruled out by assuming an NFW profile that nobody in the n-body simulation community believes in, and it's certainly a poor approximation. So we don't want to use that to, for example, answer the question of can indirect detection cover these blind spots. There are opportunities for indirect searches to discover something there, and I do think that the line is a great way to go, but, you know, there's others. I don't think that indirect detection can seriously, cover those blind spots and eliminate them from the consideration of, you know, good theoretical parameter space points.
To comment on that, I mean, so hearing those words from you, then in my brain sets what the strategy for direct detection would be. Mm-hmm. That for direct detection, given what you just said, if you're not willing to say that you can exclude, then you really do need to push direct detection experiments down to around that level, if you want to, and that would then be a target for direct detection, and hopefully you'd have corresponding signals in two places.
Yeah, I agree with that. And on this line, getting to neutrino telescopes. Neutrino telescopes, of course, have a great way to bridge between direct and indirect detection.
That's right.
And so, for example, in the nearly pure Higgs-Zeno job of Wino limits, unfortunately, you tend to suppress direct detection cross-sections because you have no mixing, for example, in the Higgs-Zeno Gaugino. And so you tend to suppress neutrino telescope rates. So one might well be pessimistic in that realm, but again, there's I think room for opportunities.
Sorry, Marcella, who gets the microphone? Catherine, don't talk.
Okay. So even if you get down to this 10 to the minus 47 centimeters squared where you could probe pure Higgs-Zeno, you can still easily get into one of these blind spots and go down to the 10 to the minus 48 centimeters squared level with only a factor of, 10 fine tuning between the parameters. So I think it's safe to say that it's going to be very hard. Indirect detection can certainly help you, but it's going to be very hard to just kill the parameter space.
Jesse, if I recall, low energy supersymmetry or weak scale supersymmetry is motivated by naturalness.
Yep.
If I heard you right, you were saying something along the lines of, look at all the other things it does for us. Maybe we should relax our naturalness requirements. But I'm coming to a question. The question is, for this mini desert, how broad can the desert be before these other things stop working?
So a couple comments on that. So one comment is about precise measurements of naturalness, and I have just completely lost all my standards for that. I was willing maybe a year ago to put a hard line, and you know, I want to see these particles at these scales. But I've backed away from that partly because I see opportunities, and I see the amazing performance of the LHC, and I'm thinking, really, am I going to give up on something because I have 1.2 TeV gluinos, and I'm not willing to push it up to 2 TeV for some two-loop effect? I don't know. But while it's true that one of the motivations for supersymmetry is naturalness, supersymmetry is always quote-unquote natural in the sense that once you have supersymmetry, you cancel off quadratic divergences. And what we really are arguing about, as Xerxes pointed out, was logarithmic effects. And maybe you don't understand logarithmic effects, but one thing is certainly the case, is that you can have supersymmetry consistent in a quasi-decoupled regime where you have to fine-tune parameters to get the Higgs to land where it is. And I see that as plausible. And in some sense, the way you respond to Higgs at 126 tells you that if it is supersymmetry, it probably isn't completely decoupled. Because if it were completely decoupled, you tend to be dragged up to even a little bit higher Higgs masses. And it seems to be pointing towards supersymmetry kind of being in a range where, yeah, people can say it's uncomfortable for naturalness, but it's not something where you know, one part in a thousand between friends, you know, my friends who talk about nuclear physics and talk about, you know, accidents in nuclear spectra, they would say, yeah, one part in a thousand, okay, it happens. But I think your point is exactly what I wanted to emphasize, which are that there are ubiquitous elements of supersymmetric models that we can point to where we can be a little bit more agnostic about naturalness and still have a reason to see these other things. When do I stop working?
When
do? so when do these stop That's an excellent question, which I don't have an answer off the top of my head, what scale I would put for that. What?
You get unification in split SUSY, so that scale can be very high.
So in the case of split supersymmetry, you are still keeping some of the partner's light. You're leaving the fermion's light, and if you allow me to leave the fermion's light and decouple, I'm happy with split SUSY. If you really force me to kind of lift the Higgsinos, the Gaygenos up as well, you know, then I get more uncomfortable. And precision unification tends to want to leave you a little bit lighter for the fermions.
Yeah, probably also can do a lot with the threshold corrections, correct, at the high scale.
You do threshold corrections at the high scale, or Radovan's going to tell us how we can also kind of sprinkle in some extra vector-like generations. And
so I wanted to return to this idea of filling in blind spots using imperfect detection. So, I mean, I think it's true that with neutrino telescopes, you can basically fill in high-mass models that are mixed Gaygeno, Higgsino states that you can't get at with direct detection. So that's helpful. But with, you know, gamma rays and things like that, I don't think you're going to be able to fill in very much. I don't think it's really true that CTA will reach the thermal cross-section, for example. Those limits are actually, that you see on this, are extremely optimistic, and they don't really take into account fluctuations in the background properly. So I would not bank on that. It would probably be useful for lines, but not for the continuum.
Other?
Well, so the thing I want to know is what's not on this list? And for those of you who are SUSY model builders, or actually, there's two things. One is what's not on the list, and will someone take me up on this question about targets for flavor? I want to, for this particular one, I want someone to tell me, you know, what I can tell colleagues in other areas about the intensity frontier and targets for some of these, excellent probes of high energy physics. I don't know if Andre is still here, but.
Can you go first?
I mean, So I have a couple of comments, and I don't know in what order to make them, because I think, so let me start from the more general comment, that I think that we are, sort of the last 30 years has put the field into this strange paradigm that any new project has to promise some discovery. And I think we have to get away from it. That's not how the field used to work. And if you look at the history of discoveries, I mean, maybe the funding agencies will tell us that we can't get away from it, but you know, since the early 80s, we knew that the LHC will answer questions about electrovic cement breaking by discovering the Higgs or something else, strong WW scattering, whatever, there were a number of options. I think at this point, we can all be hopeful that in 2015, we'll see SUSY when the LHC turns on at 13, 14 PeV, but there are no guarantees. So asking this question, where is it that you can guarantee some new discovery, is setting up the field for a failure. And I think it's extremely dangerous.
Can I just comment on that? Is that I didn't mean this as a comment on the I just want to know, is there a number? Whether we see it or not, I agree, that's the wrong paradigm. But just know, what is there a number? What if we're shooting for the moon, we say for a given supersymmetric scenario, we want to be able to test, let's say, baryon, lepton flavor, quark flavor violation at this level in order to exclude something. Is there a target for that? Is there a target for shooting for the moon?
If you see the moon, there is a target, absolutely. Yeah. But I think you have answered the question yourself in your talk when you said that flavor has been a key constraint on model building. And therefore, I would turn it around and say that wherever you can increase sensitivities by an order of magnitude or more, to some new physics that is not yet constrained, I think that's extremely exciting. Because maybe some of you think you know where new physics is, I don't.
Mucho, wait.
Another example I could give you is the baryon number violation. For example, this golden mofer from K being to plus I zero, that doesn't require any supersymmetry. And I think the generic model expectation would be around 10 to the 35 years.
I don't know who has the...
I have a question, a little. First of all, as you know, I'm very sympathetic to this idea that things are, that SUSY might be there and it might be a little bit removed. One area you didn't talk about, which is certainly on the menu of things, facilities we're talking about, is ILC. In your wish list or whatever, is there a part of your idea space where the ILC is a valuable machine, either for illumination or for discovery?
Good. So ILC means different things in my own brain. So there's kind of initial stage ILC, which I see as being very important for indirect tests of Higgs properties. And that, for me, is a primary motivation to get the project underway. Then, as you start going towards wanting to go to higher energy, then the next target, as Xerxes was talking about, was hoping that there is some electroweak states that are light that we are not uncovering at the LHC because of just getting unlucky. It's harder for me to bet against the LHC. I would hope that if really you had Higgsinos that were right around the corner, that one would be able to do something like mono anything searches in order to dig that out. So I'm not willing to bet against the LHC, but that's something where certainly if we had evidence for or if we wanted to search for ILC would play a role there. Then going beyond that in the context of supersymmetry, that's where I would want other people to help me get an opinion. Because unfortunately, I tend to have my brain go off in this decoupling regime. And once you start sliding in the decoupling regime, it's just hard to have direct production of things. And then for indirect tests, it's a question of, in supersymmetric models, for example, do we need better measurements of the Higgs coupling to TOPS, for example? Higgs coupling to W's and Z's, are they actually going to exclude space, or is it basically, you know, all covered in this kind of indirect test for Higgs properties, maybe dominated by the two Higgs doublet nature? that's where I need help from someone to tell me about kind of beyond electroweak enostates and precision Higgs properties.
Yeah, I think just a short comment is that you are talking about the infamous wedge, correct? And so yeah. That is a place where it would be interesting to know for an ILC how well it can do just using these indirect tests through Higgs properties. And I don't think, you know, we looked at this some time ago, but maybe it's time to get now a closer look now that you know that the Higgs is there.
Right, and kind of the numbers that I was vaguely getting, and I wish Nathaniel Craig was still here, but it was vaguely kind of 300, 400 GeV was the numbers that I was vaguely getting, but I'm not 100% sure of that. And I would love to know whether you could dig further.
He's
my subordinate. So regarding the infamous wedge, there is one characteristic that defines the infamous wedge, is that tangent beta is not very large. So the branching rate of Higgs to tau tau becomes small. Actually, most of the decay in that infamous wedge of these heavy Higgses are, if you assume that they are at the weak scale, into enos. Mm-hmm. And that should provide an opportunity to explore that that wedge, provided the enos are light. Mm-hmm. If the enos are heavy, of course, disappear. So.
Studies from 2006, from experimentalists, actually.
I just want to change the subject a little bit. I want to make a comment about mono anything.
Yeah.
So, I don't think a precise study for the SUSY scenario has been done, but of course it depends a little bit on the splitting between the chargenos and the neutralinos, whether you can, in optimistic scenario, you maybe take advantage of the small splitting, see some soft leptons. But if we forget about that, and just say mono jet, you know, my guess will be that in the optimistic scenario where you still produce the chargino and so on, but don't see the decay product. But in that optimistic limit, I think the limit is at LHC is should be around 500.
That's a pair production of 500 GeV
yeah.
objects.
Yeah, that's my guess. Okay. Again.
LHC 300.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say, and of course, so after that, you really become rate limited because you have to cut pretty hard on the jet, and again, you know, additional soft leptons may help. So now to get to the dark matter regime, now you know, then we just multiply that factor, central mass. That's the central mass of PP collision you need to have. Mm-hmm.
Sultan wanted to add something, and then.
No. So actually, there's a little bit more concrete answer to your question. Yesterday in Andre's talk, he showed the CKM Peter plot and said that well, things have been tested so nicely in the quark sector, in the lepton sector, we are not yet there. In fact, that plot doesn't tell you how well or how badly things have been tested in the quark sector, because that plot assumes the standard model. If you ask the question, how well do you know that any flavor changing neutral current process is given by the standard model, you say BB by mixing, B2S gamma, etc. In each of these cases, there is of order 10, 20, 30% room left for new physics. So if you ask how big new physics contributions can be compared to the standard model, the bounds are not that great. And if you assume generic or even more specific TeV scale new physics, it's quite easy to come up to an answer that yes, I'm not expecting 50% deviations, but I could easily get a few percent deviations. And that's the goal of the next generation of B factory in Japan, to try to get in as many of these FCNC processes down from tens of percents to a few percent. And I think it's the slew of models written down in the last decades, well, there are effects predicted that you can find, possibly by reducing the uncertainties by an order of magnitude. So whether it will be successful or not, I'm not a fortune teller.
Right. So, in that vein, just to point out, partly why I was provoking about having targets is because at least I do have one target in the case of B-mixing, which is in this particular scenario, this kind of splitting that you would get gives you a contribution, where the only mixing angles are CKM, and it's kinematics, the kinematic separation between these states, which gives you an effect in B-mixing. And there, having 1% measurement would be fantastic for.
So concretely, in BB biomixing, that's a very simple system to parameterize, and the bounds currently, depending on the weak phase of the new contribution, is somewhere in the 10 to 30, 40%, whether it's aligned or not with the standard model.
More comments or questions, agreements, disagreements? Michael, any final any final input from your side?
I'm not really sure what question to ask here. At the end of the session yesterday, I said we would come back and debate whether we're giving up on supersymmetry. And Jesse has staked out this very careful mid-range position.
Yes, but no.
If anyone would like to make a more extreme statement one way or the other, now is the time. So please speak up.
Well, I would say something, actually, at least what I think, which is like Catherine was saying, points of view are colored by what we feel a bit more than only the facts, okay? But I think that what is obviously clear is that it would be too premature, in my opinion, to give up on supersymmetry when we have only explored a small region of parameter space. And of course, the question was asked about naturalness. I'm not a big fan of naturalness, and I can say that loudly because I was not a big fan of naturalness when everybody was a big fan of naturalness. Now it's easy not to be because nature is trying to push us in that direction, correct? So everybody's changing hats. But I think that we have a lot of data to come from a marvelous machine starting in hopefully a couple of years. And so that is really where we should put our expectations, okay? And in looking for supersymmetry particles or other new particles that could be around the corner, and they're all these kind of blind spots that we have been discussing here and there. So I think it's, of course, we have to be cautious how we package our expectations, and Simona is there, so even more careful how we package our expectations. But I think it's certainly, without being super optimistic, I think that would be totally silly to give up on supersymmetry at this moment. And of course, we have all these other handles that we were thinking about, not LHC, concerning intensity frontier type of flavor physics. We have a unique opportunity, as Zoltán was saying, to explore and push the frontiers. So we should obviously be doing that as well, correct? And well, for that matter, we will have a full session later today. But I think that's so we are in a very good position. We just discovered an amazing particle. We have a lot to do with that. He wants to leave, that means.
So, in connection with what Michael says about giving up on supersymmetry or whatever, two comments. One is, I think we need something better, and as far as I know, we haven't gotten something better, certainly not anthropics. But on what Marcella said, But with what Marcella said, what we need to do in the future is not necessarily look for supersymmetry or look for your other favorite thing, but what we can all agree on is we want to break the standard model. And That is a very definite and concrete goal in my view.
Can I comment on that? So in breaking the standard model, I agree 100% we need to break the standard model, but at some point we have to make priorities. And the thing that I was trying to convey is one priorities is take well-motivated scenarios and ask for those well-motivated scenarios, what are the targets that they give you for things to attack? Now we can discuss whether that's the right strategy. So that's the of course, as someone who's worked on any number of zillions of models, I want to be surprised. But you know, if I put on the hat of someone thinking about supersymmetry, there are specific directions that one is driven towards, and where I would put more emphasis on versus other ones. But in a perfect world, of course, we would have full exploration. But if eventually we're asked to prioritize, one way of doing that is by looking at specific model scenarios.
Yeah, that actually ties into what I wanted to bring up, was, as we all know, supersymmetry is just an interesting theoretical framework with an enormous parameter space. We've known this for a long time. We've known that it's hard to map this thing out. But one question I wanted to ask to this room and to the community in general is about, do we want, as model builders and those of us who build SUSY models, is there a need for more benchmarks of some sort of non-standard type or not? Because if you build such models, many times people say, oh, we already have plenty of SUSY models. And on the other hand, you wonder, are they really covering this enormous parameter space, right? I mean, there are many sort of, I work on top-down, there's many types of strange-looking models that it's hard to imagine, you know, packaging them in some way to experimentalists saying use them. On the other hand, maybe we can get some sense, try to look for corners that haven't been uncovered. But what's not clear sometimes is that there is certain pushback from some places, you know, saying we don't need more models. There's certainly the PMSSM strategy, which is a way to try to overcome that. And, you know, my hat's off to you guys for doing these extremely complicated things with all these parameters. But it also can be nice to fit them in with some specific model scenarios as well, understand those corners. But that's a question. Is that something we should be, I mean, not should. Is it something that many people in the room would consider a priority?
Lisa, could I just make a comment? I'm speaking for the PMSSM people, of whom I am not one. But I very often walk into Tom's office and say, do you have, or Amit, actually Amit's office, and say, do you have a model that looks like that? And they've got a huge database, so I encourage model builders to do that.
Rohini? I wanted to sort of reemphasize the point that for the wedge, perhaps looking at what IRC can do through indirect measurements and the virtual effects. Because I remember from the Tesla days, there was a big fill-up of that wedge from Tesla measurements. But things have to be completely taken a re-look at in view of what we know, which is basically the major thing is the Higgs mass. Mm-hmm. But I think that would be an important contribution to mm-hmm. this mass process.
Are we giving up on SUSY?
So I'm trying to think about how to exactly answer Michael's question. It's probably worth thinking even a little bit more broadly than Jesse presented beautifully today. So the first thing is, you know, about giving up or not giving up. You know, the story that always comes to mind to me with that question is it's a very famous quote, which I'm sure most of you have heard, but bears repeating, about in the early part of the 20th century, Justice Brandeis was asked to define pornography. And he said, I can't define pornography, but I'll know it when I see it. And I think of similarly about, you know, dynamics responsible for electroweak symmetry breaking. You know, when do you give up? You know, this is why, like Marcel, I've always been uncomfortable with the whole naturalness conversation. I can't define it, really, but I think I'll know it when I see it, one way or the other. And so now, in figuring out how one moves forward, first of all,
we're at such an early stage of the LHC, why anyone would ever think about saying, well, it's the standard model, nothing else, based on what we've seen today, seems to completely ludicrous to me. The object beyond supersymmetry is to answer the question, is there dynamics responsible for electroweak symmetry breaking that goes beyond the standard model, question mark, and will we see any evidence for that dynamics in our machines? And the LHC has a long and rich lifetime ahead, a factor 2 in energy, a factor of 10 to 100 in luminosity. That's a huge reach. Yes, we should be using models to inform how we do searches, with the caveat that it's easy to miss things if you think too narrowly. On that issue, by the way, again, let me speak to the young people. Think a little bit about that infamous LHC wedge region, because I can't believe that there's nothing you can do about it. And just as a simple example, if you're in a two Higgs doublet model structure, then you can have decays to light Higgses in that region. And there has been suggestions from time to time that, yeah, I know there's a little thing, but I think I've at least Tillman Plenn tells me that he did a preliminary study at some point, a future LHC running, that says you can start to carve regions into that wedge. And people should think seriously about other possible probes. But to finish up the thought, this is, to me, why the ILC is so incredibly important, because you know, this whole thing about discovery versus precision, I still assert that we learned more about the standard model from 10 years of running at LEP than we did in almost any other machine. And it was just an amazing advance in knowledge that we got from that. And here at the ILC, where you have a precision Higgs factory, where you can begin to explore at the precision that one did at LEP, and here you're exploring the fundamental object which is associated with electroweak symmetry breaking. If you want to head in that direction, that has to be an essential part of our future program. So.
Okay. On that note, anyone else? Yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to ask a question to you folks that you don't have to answer now, but I really would appreciate some help with this. Apropos of this discussion, it's necessary by the virtue of these snowmass type reports that Chip and I have to say something about the question. So we're going to say a lot about what can be done between now and at the LHC 300 inverse femtobarns. We're going, I think, to have a lot to say about 300 to 3,000. But we definitely have to say something about the question, if no new particles are seen by 3,000, then do we want to go to 33 TeV or 100 TeV? And any sensible information you folks can give us to help us provide a good answer to this question would be greatly appreciated. And it doesn't have to be the answer to this question. Send us email, of course. Information from the other frontiers is important, but as I say, any help you can give us with this, we'd really appreciate.
Okay, last comment, or whatever.
I would like to ask a question prompted by Michael's question. I mean, have you heard an argument why the answer could be no? And if so, what it is? Other than the prejudice that it must be the standard model in that case, which I disagree with. Someone must claim that, if that came up as a question, someone must claim that the answer is that we don't want to do it, and I would like to have an argument, to hear an argument, how someone can argue for that answer.
Well,
Well, all I can say is that you can't just say it's because I think that there's something there.
Michael, can I just, the conversation you're having is identical, I think, to this question here of, is it valid to push the frontier without a specific goal? And I think Zoltan and I are on the side of saying yes. so being asked to...
I should say that at our Brookhaven meeting, Nima gave a talk in which he said the goal is 100 TeV superparticles. So we're not going to get there with the VLHC, but in a century we'll get there, and we have to be on that road. So, I mean, that's not a stupid thing to say. But it hasn't been said yet today, so I thought I would mention it. There are a lot more ideas out there. We would appreciate your help in putting them together so we can put together the best document possible.
Maybe, Michael, there are two sides of your point, correct? I mean, do we believe that it's exciting to keep pushing the frontiers and exploring? I suppose the answer is yes for everybody in this room. Are we going to be successful if we don't have a real convincing point to make? And, you know, in this climate, as Simone was saying yesterday, okay, well, the climate may change, but we have to survive. We have to survive to keep pushing the frontier, correct? So these are two different questions, and we have to answer both. Maybe the first is very easy. That's my opinion. Okay, on this note, I think we all go for lunch and come here at 1:15.
So back at in an hour at 1:15. And thank you very much.